This is the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast.
Hello, and welcome to episode 25 of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast, the most mechanical podcast in the business. My name is Matt Wolf, and I'm your host. Our topic for this episode is turning a mechanism into a game. And with me this time are two designers who hope to be more Tin Man than Cowardly Lion. First up is Adam Skelding. Hey, Adam.
Hey, Matt. How you doing? I want to be more Iron Man than Tin Man, even.
Iron
Man. That's what
I'm
going for here.
Yeah, let's move up in the periodic table. I like that. And the second designer with us today is Graham Allen. Hey, Graham.
Hey, Matt. How are you doing?
Oh, and Graham's already losing it. That's excellent. All right, so we're going to switch up our segments a little bit for this episode. We're going to move the news segment first because we want to talk about the Cardboard Edison Award, which is tangentially related to the group here. We have, I believe, three of us are going to be judges this year in the award. Myself, Burke Drew, and Chris Kirkman are all judges this year. I don't think there's anyone else. I might be mistaken on that. So we thought we'd talk about the award a little bit because in addition to several of us being judges, both Adam and Graham participated in the process last year, and they can give some advice and feedback on kind of how it went in case that if you're listening and you want to participate this year. So let's start with you, Adam. You want to talk a little bit about your experiences with the process last year?
Sure. The couple biggest things to take away from that was definitely because there's a timeline and the submission date and all that kind of stuff, it makes you do some design work. Second biggest thing is because I hadn't done any video editing, you have to learn how to do that. So I learned how to do a little bit of that, which was good. And the third thing is start as soon as possible. If you haven't already started, then start today, because the looks like the January 31st, 2017 final deadline for submissions will be here before you know it. And it creeped up really fast last year when I was working on stuff.
Yeah, always nice to have a deadline, you know, just like to really push your design process and creativity. How about you, Graham? What advice would you have about submitting and what were your impressions from last year?
Biggest advice would be to really focus on your rules document. I mean, it's going to be the most important thing. It's in my understanding, if the judges can't understand the rules of the game, even with if you've got a good video, then it's just not going to go through very well. So, I mean, I had to pick up on video editing and things of that nature when I was making mine, but I went through a good 6 or 7 drafts of already written down rules, and if I'm going to try this year, I haven't even started writing down the rules for the game that I would put in.
You're already behind.
I'm way behind.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point with the rules. I know as a judge, I am pretty much judging the submission off of my understanding of how it plays based on reading the rule book. And if I can't understand it from the rule book, then I'm probably not going to look too favorably on that design. Even if it sounds like it could be something cool, I just can't tell, get a good sense of how to play from the rules, then yeah, that's probably going to be a detriment for you. So I 100% agree. Definitely get, work on the rules, get them blind play tested and blind proofread, and make them as absolute best that you can. Your video will help a little bit. Use the video as like a 10-minute rules explanation, because that's really boring. Just try to give the crux of the game and what makes it really fun and what you're really excited about the design. What makes it really special, basically. That's what you want to focus on with your video. The rule book is absolutely critical. As Adam mentioned, the award submission deadline is January 31st, 2017. So as of this recording, you'll have, and by the time this episode drops, you'll probably have about 6 to 7 weeks to get something in. Highly recommend it. You'll get a lot of good feedback. If you make it to the finals, you're going to get a ton of in-person plays. from the final judging, and you'll get a lot of really detailed feedback. Yeah, I think there's only positives from the award. I don't think there are really any negatives other than, you know, maybe that you wouldn't get the type of feedback you're looking for. But even that is valuable, although it may not be 100% necessarily what you're looking for. So let's go into our What's in the Oven segment here. So, Graham, what have you been working on lately other than moving?
Other than moving and college, I've been trying to do more work on Lightspan. I've been investigating different ways to do in-game scoring that tries to fix a problem that I've been having, which is that the game's who's winning is too obvious, so players play to that a little bit more than I would like them to. So I'm trying to obfuscate who's in the lead a little bit more. And my current change, I think I've gone way too far and it's hidden too much, but I need to playtest it some more. And then I'll probably come to a point where I combine the two systems, the new one and then the old point system, and find something somewhere in there.
And for our listeners, remind them, what is Lightspan?
Lightspan is a worker placement game that takes place on a generation ship, and it takes place over several generations as the ship is slowly falling apart. And players are competing to become the head family, the head generational family on the ship, while they're temporarily working together to keep the ship from falling apart while they hurtle through space to an unknown destination.
Do you think you'll submit this to the Cardboard Edison Awards?
I want to, and therefore I have to start writing the rules down, because I haven't written any of the rules for this game down yet. And
All right, so listeners, Graham is being a bad game designer and has not written down his rules. That's a real bad thing for as long as you've been working on this game to only have them in your head at this point. Yeah, definitely try to jot down a rough draft, because should something happen that you don't work on it for like 3 months, you're going to forget stuff if you don't do that. So yeah, that's a don't do what Graham does, listeners.
Kind of like college, going to college for and not working on the game.
How about you, Adam? What have you been working on lately?
I've been working on trying to work on restarting my design process, but I think I'm in a really good spot because I took a new job roughly 6 months ago, and yesterday at closing time, it was the first weekend in a long, long time I felt, oh my gosh, I have nothing overhanging me for the weekend to try to get ready for Monday and stuff like that. So that is super, super encouraging. And for those of you who don't know, I actually work in the board game industry. So that is super, super encouraging, and I really feel like I can start jumping back into the design world, and that's going to be great. And I got two designs that I want to work on, one for the Cardboard Edison, which is a real tiny game, and another, which is a little bit more in-depth, bigger, longer game. So I'm happy.
Yeah, it's always nice to, you know, not have feel like you have to do day job work on the weekend. You know, it's, you actually take your weekend to do what you want to do.
So much stuff going on and so many projects and things like that, but we've taken on a couple more people, and I'm training those people, and the training is going great, and this is going to make my workload lower in the future, and it's just everything is, it's a good day.
Very good. I'm glad that that's working out, because it's a nice industry to work in, you know, from what I've heard. At least professionally, I should say. Yeah, since I'm only doing it in an amateur capacity.
So not true. You are a professional. You have two games to your credit. Right.
Oh, I mean, that is true, but in the way I would define it is making a living, then you're a professional in the industry. But that may not be everyone's definition. All right, so let's go into our main topic here, and this is turning a mechanism into a game. This topic comes to us from listener Robert Johnson, who is Senor Bob on Twitter. So thank you, Senor Bob, for sending in this idea for a show topic. So the idea here, and Bob's question was, you know, when you have an idea for a mechanism, how do you go about turning that into a game? Is there like a specific process? Are there specific things you should be doing? And so that's what we're going to talk about here today. So let's start with you, Adam. So you have an idea for a mechanism. What are the first steps that you take?
So the game I'm going to design for the Cardboard Edison contest, the mechanism idea came out of something that came up during Unpub this past year, and the limiting factor was it was 18 cards maximum in the game. So I had to try to figure out what to do with 18 cards. And this little mechanism I came up with is sort of how to place the cards on the table in front of you so that they overlap, but they only overlap in certain specific spots. And there's been a lot of games like that. I mean, Daniel Salas is king of the Tree of Kodami or whatever it is, and that's fantastic, but not quite like that, but a little bit different mechanism where basically there are kind of circles in the corners and you put your finger on that and you on two cards, and then you can turn the cards. And that mechanism, trying to put a theme on it, and finally I came up with the idea of some sort of golf course theme, because golf courses, they have dog legs left, dog legs right. But the way I just got about that is just once I sort of had that mechanism, I just started thinking of, well, what in the real world could I replicate that has things that move to the left, move to the right, they take angles, take 90 degrees or, you know, 50 degree angles. I thought of like plumbing and pipes and things like that, or maybe roadways. But then I think I've settled and I think golf is going to work. Plus, it's only 18 cards, so there's not a lot I can do with only 18 cards. So just get the mechanism, start thinking of real world examples of what can represent that mechanism in my particular case. I mean, your mileage may vary.
Okay. So how about you, Graham? If you have an idea for a mechanism, what's the first step or two that you take to try to turn that into a game?
Mine sounds pretty similar. The game that is the closest in order for this that I've been working on is Triple Lutz, the ice skating game. And that came out of doing a early playtest with one of Josh's games that had to do with making smoothies, oddly enough. And there was tile laying out on the board, and I just saw patterns that looked that kind of looked like dance moves, like the steps where you've got the foot one and foot two, and then you've got those things, whatever they're actually referred to as. And so it just looked that way, and then I wanted to create a tile laying game where you ended up with these patterns and you tried to match steps in order to create a path through things. And I immediately jumped to theme in order to try to find more mechanisms that tie into it. Instead of having the mechanism and trying to put other things onto it with no context, I immediately jumped to theme and stumbled on ice dancing as opposed to just standard dancing, because ice dancing would actually leave a track behind you on the ice, a physical map of what you've done, and went with that and haven't actually created anything from it, but excited to and have ideas. I mean, I've got judging that can be thrown in there. I've got different types of jumps. There are different types of there's all of these things that have to do with that theme that I can then use as inspiration for ways to either use that mechanic or bring another type of mechanic into it in a way that supports it, that makes sense with theme already.
Okay. So both of you, it sounds like your first step is to try to find some kind of theme for the game. And in both your examples, they happen to be real world, although I suppose it doesn't necessarily have to be real world. It could, of course, be some kind of fantasy or sci-fi or anything else like that. What do you do if you are not able to easily come up with a theme that you think would be applicable? Is there anything else that you would try, or is that sort of a roadblock until you're able to define a theme? What would you do, Graham?
I'm not sure if that would be a roadblock. It would definitely be a sticking point. I'd be stuck for a little while if I wasn't able to, because that is something that I like to do just naturally in my design process as it is. I like to have something that explains what I'm doing to myself when I'm trying to design it. It puts constraints on what I'm thinking about, and that helps me to determine what to do next. So I guess the way that I'd work through it, I haven't actually had to do this, but I would try to put those constraints on myself in an artificial manner and say, so I can't come up with a theme. Well, I have this mechanic. I had this other mechanic idea in the past. What happens if I combine them? Can I find something from that? And make it a little bit bigger, not try to design a game from it, but try to make it so that I can find something that speaks to me, is I think what I would try to do. I haven't actually, but like I said, I haven't actually done that.
Okay, how about you, Adam? What would you do if you just don't have any ideas of a theme that might be applicable?
Two words, abstract game. Done and done. Turn it into an abstract game. You don't have to worry about a theme. But I like themes, so I'm really going to try on the themes and keep on trying. And obviously, having a great support from the game designers of North Carolina or whatever your local design group is a way to go, because people can throw out ideas when your brain's just not working anymore. Yeah, if it really came down to it, I'd say, well, maybe this will make a great abstract game with a good mechanic. Because okay. Let's face it, come on. We've seen some abstract games which have some pretty skinny themes laid on top of them.
Oh, sure. Yeah, and that is a common complaint with some games out there where even if the game is, you know, fun to play or whatever, that some people just like, oh, this theme is pasted on, that, you know, that kind of almost tropish complaint at this point. So, I mean, the mechanism alone is not enough to make it into an abstract game. Of course, you have to have scoring or some way to determine a winner. So I think what you were sort of hinting at, Adam, is a next step might be trying to figure out like a scoring system that would, you know, sort of work with the mechanism. So even if you don't have a theme, maybe you can figure out, okay, is this going to be like a race game? Like, is it a race to try to get to a certain condition? Is it just going to be something where it's going to add up to points? Is it going to be something where you're going to be able to need to manipulate things into a certain like arrangement or certain circumstances in order to have a win? Or whatever the kind of the scoring system or potentially just the end game system or condition is going to be for the game. That could be like a next step as well.
I agree with you wholeheartedly. Even if the game is themeless or pretty abstract, you're still right. Like you've been saying, you need all those sort of things. You need scoring, you need end game conditions, you need rules that have to be followed. So, you know, maybe work on some of those things, and maybe the theme will come back around once you delve into some of those other areas.
Yeah. I think you know, there's definitely not like a linear path to, you know, finding a theme for a game if you're not starting with a theme. You know, if you're starting with a mechanism or if you're starting with an experience or whatever your starting point is. Yeah, it's definitely not necessarily just one way to get there. And I think it'll, you know, kind of largely depend on the type of designer, whether if they even kind of start with the mechanism. I know not everyone does, and it's just not the way their game design brain works. And that's you know, definitely nothing wrong with that. It's, for some people, it might feel more natural, you know, to go to like, trying to figure out the like, scoring system or win conditions, things like that. Some might feel more natural trying to go to a theme. Are there any other steps you can take to try to move from a mechanism and move it towards becoming into a game? Either one of you have any other ideas?
One other thing that you could possibly look at if you're stuck, especially let's say you're stuck at both theme and trying to find a way to score, is to take a look at your mechanism and try to figure out where this would fit in a game. If you look at a game's experiential story and how it goes from start to finish, is this a base mechanism? Is this a mechanism that is only really important at like the climax point of the game? Or is it something that you build up to and then come down from and try to figure out where you would fit this in a story? Not necessarily the story of the theme, but the story of the table and the experience and how the players are going through the game itself. And kind of try to nail down what that mechanic could become in the overall piece, and that might kind of launch you forward into those other things that we already talked about.
Well, way to sound all smart, college boy. Man.
Thank you very much.
I like that a lot. That's a really good kind of lens to look at the mechanism. That's not something that I had thought of, but I think that makes a lot of sense. The only other step that I can think of that you can try is to figure out the types of interactions that you think the mechanism can support or that you want to have sort of drive the mechanism. So if you think about something like a deck building game where a lot of deck builders, very, very low direct interaction usually, it kind of depends. I mean, there are some out there that where you will have a direct interaction. But generally, if you think of like the Dominion type of model, it's a lot of criticism of like multiplayer solitaire, which is not a term that some people appreciate, but I think it is kind of descriptive of the style of game. So if you had a mechanism and say, okay, what types of interactions do I think this could support? You know, it could it support direct interaction? Could it support indirect? Could it maybe support some type of social interaction? Could it support some kind of aggressive interaction and things like that? So I think that could be a step forward as well when you have that mechanism. And if you can kind of think about the types of interactions that you want to have, that can also help you to find a theme as well. For example, like if you had some type of mechanism that you feel could really support an aggressive play style, maybe that would make you think like, okay, what kind of themes are aggressive? And hey, the jungle, like the jungle is an aggressive place. There's lots of animals that are, you know, trying to survive and or trying to find prey, things like that. So maybe that would work. And so that could lead to ways to be able to take that mechanism further towards actually becoming into a game. Now, when you have a mechanism, is there any type of different kind of playtesting that you do? Or is the playtesting typically very similar to what you would do no matter what type of design you're working on? What do you think, Adam?
I think backing up just a quick second about that, once you have a mechanism that you really like and you think is going to work, one thing I'll try to do is maybe explore other games which use a similar or the same type mechanism. And get ideas from there, because like let's say worker placement as a mechanism, it's obvious it's pretty broad because there's a lot of ways you can do worker placement if you mix in, you know, like action allowance points or something, or how many workers you have. So one thing I'll definitely do is try to explore the other games that have mechanisms that are kind of similar, just because let's face it, there's maybe not a limited number of mechanisms in this world, but there's certainly a top 50 mechanisms or so, which have been used a lot. And so there's definitely games out there that are probably going to be have some overlap mechanism-wise. And so that's one thing I'll take a look at. But to the other part of that, the playtesting, I would jump in with the regular playtesting. I mean, I try to playtest just myself at the table. You know, now I'm going to play this turn. Now I'm going to play the person on my left. Now I'm going to play the person across from me. Now I'm going to play the person on my right. Or clockwise or whatever direction that works. And so I try that, and then I move on to the regular playtesting at the design groups. And I think that amount of playtesting, whether you're doing a mechanism or testing a theme or any other of 1,000 different board game design issues, that's the way to go, is jump in and get the playtesting done and, you know, work at it, and listen to the feedback from your fellow designers and or playtesters.
Okay. How about you, Graham? Is playtesting pretty much the same when you just have a mechanism that you're starting with, or is there any kind of differences in playtesting that you do?
If it's early on enough that it's pretty much still just a mechanism and I'm testing a new idea for a mechanism and I'm not testing that mechanism in a game, I would say that my playtesting goals are a lot more open-ended. I think the actual methodology is pretty much the same. I mean, I sit down and I see what happens, and I watch, take notes for when things happen certain ways and what I'm thinking about at different points during using a mechanism or such. But the questions that I'm looking to have answered are, what does this interact with this other thing? How can I make this scorable? Is this mechanic itself scorable, or am I going to have to add something to make it scorable? To turn it into a goal to such that. So I think that I might, from a lens of looking at the game and watching the playtest, I'm step back a little further, but I don't really think I'd do it any different.
Okay. Yeah, I think that makes sense. Yeah, I think keeping it open-ended is a good thing to keep in mind. Yeah, being really kind of malleable to where the design could go is probably going to be really beneficial when you're really in that early stage. And I think that a common phrase that I think Gil Hova is probably the most famous for is, you know, find the fun. You know, that's one of his mantras. And that's probably something that can really help drive those early play tests of trying to turn that mechanism into a game. You know, what is fun about that mechanism? You know, what do players want to do I know that Drew in our group, he does this a lot, where he just has like an idea for a mechanism, and we'll just quickly try to play it, you know, at a meeting and try to see what seems like a fun thing to do. And these, for whatever reason, tend to be a lot of dexterity games. I guess that's just where Drew's brain is sometimes. You know, so like one of them was a stacking game, and it was about having basically you were a waiter that you needed to carry food out to the customer. So we were stacking the actual pieces on the box lid. So then you had to be able to pick up the box lid and carry it over to the table and without dropping anything. And so there was a lot of very rapid changes just from that mechanism. The idea of stacking everything on the box lid and having to carry it over. And then it was just very open-ended and trying to really find what players really just wanted to do in and around that kind of mechanism. Yeah, I think find the fun is kind of a good thing to keep in mind, although it can be potentially limiting depending on the kind of design that you're working on. But for a lot of stuff, I think it works really, really well.
Kind of it's similar to find the fun, but one of the things that I do, more specifically when I'm testing putting a mechanism into a game I've already been working on, is finding the confusion. So it works the exact opposite way of finding the fun. You don't want the confusion, or at least the bad confusion. So find the sticking point, find what players are doing wrong, find what they misunderstand, and identify whether it's the mechanic itself or the way that you've explained it.
That might have a lot to do with lots of rules which haven't been written yet for your games there, Graham.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. But you need to have that phrase have alliteration, though. Find the fun. You can remember that. So you need a C word that goes with confusion. I'm not sure what it would be, but once you have that, then that'll become a standard phrase.
Avoid the slog.
But that's not alliteration, though. That's right. We don't need to come up with it off the top of our head. But yeah, listeners, if you have a really good phrase for that, let us know, because I think that is a really good point. It is sort of the opposite of find the fun, and you know, sort of the other side of the coin. And so that is an important thing to think about. All right, are there any other aspects of this topic that we want to talk about before we go into part two of the episode?
I think I'm okay.
I think I am as well.
All right. So part two is we're going to do a live on-air exercise right now where we're going to have a mechanism and we're going to try to turn it into a game. And who knows how this is going to go. This is not pre-scripted. We're going to give it a shot. So here's the idea is you have tiles that are in your player color and they're going to act as workers, and you can place them on your turn on a worker placement spot out on the board. And depending on who else has already gone to that spot, what other colors are already there, potentially the type of worker placement spot that you're going to, that'll all have some kind of impact on the game. But the idea is instead of a more typical worker placement game where once you take the spot, it's locked out for the round, here you can still, place your worker on top of other workers that are there, but the stack will somehow influence and change potentially what that worker placement spot is going to do, or maybe just change like the economy, or it'll basically have some type of in-game effect that'll make you kind of dynamically evaluate whether you want to place something on that spot. So that's the mechanism. So think like if you guys have seen those plastic counting tiles that they have in like classrooms and stuff, they're like 1 inch by 1 inch. There'll be a solid color plastic, blue, red, green, whatever. So those would be the tiles that players would have. And so on their turn, they're going to place one somewhere out on the board in a worker placement spot. Could be other tiles already there. It could be empty. That's the idea. So what's going to be what's our first step to try to turn this into a game? Who's got something?
Well, Graham's got something. Go for it, Graham.
Well, I do. Stacking 1x1 colored blocks. The thing that kind of immediately yelled at me was floors of a building, and the potential idea of expanding upon the idea of the mechanic in that maybe you never get your workers back, and you build all these floors of these different buildings, and throughout the entire game the buildings just gets taller. So it's not just that it's not just for this one placement that it matters, but down the game, that down later in the game, when you've got a 7-story tall building, that means something different than the first turn of the game when it was a 1-story tall building. So you work for your placement, what you want to actually do, but you also want to build. You might want to build certain buildings taller, faster than other people would.
Okay, so like these are maybe towers or skyscrapers or something like that.
Something like that.
All right. Yeah, I think that so we're sort of jumping to a little bit of a theme, yeah, which is what we talked about. And how about you, Adam? What do you have any other ideas or riff on on that one?
Yep, I do. Let's say this action spot is something where we get something, either money, resources, you know, some sort of common something that happens with the worker placement games. And since the tiles are two-sided, you can play your tile face up or face down. And if you play it face up, you get a full complement of whatever is on that spot. But if you play it face down, you only get a half complement of what is on that spot or something to that effect. And when you pull your tiles back, you flip them so that you can never use the full strength of this tile you're putting out two times in a row. One turn, you're going to put the full strength tile out face up. When you bring it back to you at the end of the turn, you flip it over. And the second time, you can only put half, like a half strength worker out or something to that effect. And maybe if there's a limited number of resources in these areas, the first person gets half of what's there. Let's say a full share would get half of what's there, a flip side worker would only get a quarter of what's there. So,
okay.
And then you start talking into the counting. Okay, there's only five things here. If I'm going to get half, rounded up, I get three, and then the next person is only going to get a quarter, so they're only going to get two or one. I don't know. Some odds and ends like that. But so you'd be thinking about, do I want to play my full strength workers here to try to get a bigger share of this, or do I want to play my half share workers and save the full strength workers for another spot on the board?
So that sort of implies to me that the workers might actually be unique then. Or at least you might have like some workers of one type and some workers of a different type. So those workers could, you know, do I want to use this type of worker at this location full strength, or do I want to use him somewhere else full strength, knowing that next turn he's going to be on the other side, which might be, you know, like half strength or whatever. And then... Right. Half strength might be good enough to use at this other location next turn instead.
It just gets you you only need two of something, and a half strength worker will get it for you. Use the half strength worker. Let's say you start with four tiles, four workers. Two of them start full strength workers, and two of them start as half strength workers. And you would get that just went up in flames or down in flames. If you pull them back and you flip them over, you're still ending up with two and two no matter what you do.
Well, at the beginning, but you know, if there's some way to get more workers, then you'd have a little bit of ebb and flow. Or potentially there might be different rules of how you get workers back. Maybe you don't get them all back right away. Maybe depending on the spot that you go and the strength of the worker will depend on how long they're going to be there. So there could be ways to not always just have, you know, the two and two or basically the opposite of whatever you had the previous turn.
Maybe pull the full strength workers back and you don't get to play them for a turn because they're resting up. So workers. Half strength worker you can play over and over and over again, but the full strength worker you can only play once every other turn.
There's also that the workers are on the stack in an order, so it could be that placing a high strength worker really early on the low end of the stack, only a certain number of workers come back off the spot and the other ones are stuck there left on the table. So the later played workers are going to come back, but maybe since you've got a half and a whole and there's a limited number on the spots, playing later means you'll get your worker back, but it also means that there might be less left in that location for you to have grabbed.
Okay. So that could be a way that you could just maybe block someone that went earlier, even though maybe you're not going to get anything, but you're just going to prevent them from getting some kind of a resource from that spot.
Yeah, or delay the time when they get that worker back, so the next round they are working with a lower worker pool.
Yeah. So if it would have that type of kind of interaction, then that's going to make for potentially a very mean and spiteful game, which is not necessarily a problem, but that could be very interesting just by, yeah. So there we're kind of looking at the interaction that the players could have, and so would stacking those tiles, would that be able to support sort of like that very, and I guess in that way it would be a very direct, aggressive type of interaction. And is that something that mechanism would support? It might. That could be a very very aggressive type of game. What about if you manage to stack two of your own workers together? Maybe that could have some type of effect on a spot. Maybe it locks it out, or maybe it gives you some kind of bonus or something like that. So that might cause other players to pay attention and take into account, okay, if I go at this other spot over here, I'll get X. But that means that I open up the potential that I'm leaving this other spot open where, you know, Adam could place his other worker, and now he's got a double stack of his own type, and that means that he's going to get, you know, like X times 3 or something. And I don't know, maybe that would be something that could be kind of incorporated, the order of the stacking, and if you're able to do kind of more than one.
Perhaps going back to an action is, you know, choosing a spot on the board, but instead of having a cleanup phase where everyone pulls their workers off the board, a separate action is taking a worker back. So that's where you can really start to block people out. But maybe if you put two workers in a row, no matter how many other players' workers are on top of you, you can always take those two workers back. So you're encouraged to try to play your workers together, that even if someone tries to block you, you can get your, you don't have to wait for them to pull their worker off, and you can get your workers back sooner.
Oh, how about this? How about if when you place a worker on the top of a stack, the color worker that you are placing will have some type of interaction with that location, and then you're going to take the worker off the bottom of the stack, which may be a different color, or it could be the same color, and then that worker you'll have that you could place on a subsequent turn or any future turn. So you might have like a sort of like a first in, first out queue on the location, and that might have some really interesting dynamic properties of, okay, I'm going to place a blue worker on this location, which is going to give me, you know, 5 gold plus 1 something else because it's a blue worker and then they're specialized for this location. And that's going to pop off a red worker that's on the bottom of the stack, and then that red worker for this location isn't as good as the blue worker, but I know I'm going to need it for this other location over there in order to put a red, you know, to get extra stuff on that location. But unfortunately, that's going to pop off maybe a gray worker that I don't care about, and the gray workers are always terrible or something like that. I don't know. Maybe that could be something.
Yeah, I like that. So instead of having your own tiles of your own color, the tiles are just workers independent of your own ownership of those tiles. You just have to have whatever you have in front of you is the people you have working for you right then. And they're not always, you know, it's like you're going to hire people, day laborers every day. So, you know, someday you're going to hire them, someday someone else is going to hire them.
Yeah, that could be interesting. Now, I guess it would probably be really fiddly to take the bottom tile off of a stack like that, but I don't know, maybe it would be a way to not make it, not make it too bad.
Big chunky bakelite tiles.
yeah, like the hive tiles.
Yeah, absolutely.
So this is definitely moving towards having some game elements. It's certainly not a game yet. Scoring would have to be probably for this kind of thing. I'm going to guess probably victory points. You'd have to be able to complete, you know, contracts or complete objectives or things like that, and those things will have a certain number of victory points. That's kind of where I think this would probably lead to. I suppose you could have maybe some type of board condition where if you manage to get some kind of arrangement of workers, my secret goal was to have every single location controlled by blue workers or something like that. That would probably be pretty difficult, I think, to try to implement something like that. So to me, the natural inclination is probably some kind of VP type of structure. And then you most likely would have maybe a threshold that you hit the VP and that will trigger the end game, or perhaps you would just have rounds in some manner that you are tracking. I think that's probably where my inclination would be taking me in terms of trying to have a scoring system and a win system or a win condition for this game. Any other thoughts about our exercise here before we wrap it up?
Well, tiles, I mean, you kind of mentioned it with board state, but tiles also work really well with area control.
Mm-hmm.
However, this goes back to the idea of that term, the finding the confusion, is that any form of area control that enters a three-dimensional space, since we're stacking these tiles, becomes really difficult for a lot of people to hold in their head and predict and manipulate. So while the tiles often do well with area control, our stacking of tiles might make that just not work.
Agreed, yeah. There's a game called Town Center, which is a 3D cube stacking game. I love that game, but boy, does that just mess with people's heads. It's all about trying to predict and see how your town center is going to grow based on spatial arrangements. And because it's 3D, like you said, Graham, that just makes people's brains sometimes just go haywire. But it's a really cool game, and I like that one a lot. But it's definitely not one that everyone can grok. So yeah, if we are stacking tiles, some type of spatial arrangement like that would definitely be an issue for at least some amount of gamers.
I just played a prototype in down at BGGCon a couple of weeks ago, which sort of had a similar component. It had a not just area control across two dimensions, but it was area control across three dimensions.
Hmm.
As dice of your color were stacked on top of the other dice. And there were limits on the number of dice that could go in those spots and things like that. But then there were area control victories or bonuses for in the, not just the X and the Y, but the Z direction.
Oh, that was Daryl's prototype, right?
It was.
Yeah. I played that at Gen Con. I liked the, I liked what he had at that time. I know he's been working on it. Yeah. Now that one I think works because it's compact enough that the 3D area control spatial recognition isn't overwhelming. You know, you have what, like seven dice or something like that.
Sounds about right.
Yeah. And so that one, yeah, he's reined it in enough that it doesn't get overwhelming. But I think in a game like this where, like, in my mind, I'm seeing, like, maybe there could be like 7-8 tiles in a stack at some point, you know, who knows, like that, I could see that getting potentially overwhelming for some players. And then, you know, multiply that by the number of stacks that you've got. And yeah, that could become problematic. But Daryl's game is, yeah, it's pretty solid when I played it. And I'm sure it's only gotten better since then. All right. Anything else we want to add to our little exercise here?
I think I'm good. Unfortunately, now I've got these ideas in my head. And I'm, you know. I should concentrate on the other thing for the Cardboard Edison contest and this other design I've been sort of working on. But now all I can think about is stacking tiles and half-strength workers and getting resources.
Yeah, it's an infection.
Yep.
All right. So
it's a good infection.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully this was useful for you listeners and a little bit instructive of how you just try to brainstorm to take a mechanism towards something that will eventually turn into a game. All right. So, Graham, if people want to get in contact with you, how can they do so?
You can find me at Twitter. I am at Feathermore, FEATHERMOORE.
And very good. And Adam, if people want to get in contact with you, how can they do so?
Twitter also is probably the easiest thing. I am at Spur Serif. That's Spur, S-P-U-R, underscore Serif. S-E-R-I-F. It's a dorky graphic design term. So I totally regret choosing it now, but, you know, I thought I was all hip doing the graphic design term when I signed up for Twitter 2 years ago. And now I'm like, ugh. But that's where I am, and that's where I'll be.
Nah, it's memorable. You know, there's nothing else out there that I've seen that is similar, so people can remember it, and remembering is half the battle.
True.
All right, and listeners, if you want to contact me, you can do so also on Twitter, at Matt Wolf, with an E on the end of Wolf. And it's actually the same username on BoardGameGeek, in case you prefer to send me a geek mail through that service. We also have a Twitter account that you can follow for the group, which is at GD of NC, which, of course, stands for Game Designers of North Carolina. If you agree or disagree or have any comments with that you want to share about the episode, please join and comment in our guild on BoardGameGeek. If you go to podcast.gdofnc.com, that'll send you directly to our guild that we use for the podcast on BoardGameGeek. We love to have comments, criticisms, really any kind of feedback is great. Don't feel that you can't criticize or even just lavishly praise us. That's fine too. We'll take that. But really any kind of feedback is something that we really appreciate. And that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Game Designers of North Carolina podcast. Remember to design with the mechanical precision of a Swiss watch, and we will see you next time.